Back in 1980, 70% of clothing worn by Americans was made by Americans. Today, it's 2%. And the reason is simple. It's cheaper to make things overseas. But that doesn't change the fact that 2% of textile manufacturers have refused to give up on this country. And those companies deserve to be congratulated. I'm talking about companies like American Giant. American Giant controls every link in their supply chain, and that matters because when you buy from American Giant, you create jobs for people in factory towns all across this country. Look, I get it. Nobody wants a lecture. But if you want to see more companies make more things in this country, you got to support the companies who are already doing that very thing. This holiday, check out the clothing at American-Giant.com. Flannels, hoodies, t-shirts, and jeans made to last a lifetime. Support the 2% who are still making it here at American-Giant.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a compassionate guide for those seeking to heal and thrive. Introducing your host, Monique Cohen, a certified trauma recovery coach and fellow traveler on the path to healing. In this podcast, we will engage in heartfelt conversation with experts in the field of trauma healing. We'll explore ways to cultivate feeling safe in our bodies and in connection to others, so that we can be present to live the life we've been given more fully and with more joy. Join us as we navigate the way towards a life restored. Introducing your host, Monique Cohen.
Welcome, Allison, to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. I can't tell you. I'm so excited to just have this discussion and just be part of this community, really.
That's wonderful. Well, for those who don't know you, maybe you can introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I would love to. So my name's Allison. I'm a clinical psychologist. I specialize in trauma. I'm an author of a book. Overall, I would say the things I guess is most relevant to know about me is I'm a trauma specialist. And goodness, that's been, someone asked me this the other day, like, how long have you been doing this work? And I went to say 10 years and I was like, oh God, no, time's gotten away from me. It's 15 years now. But yeah, so it's 15 years. I've had the utmost privilege of hearing stories of people. My lifelong privilege of receiving people's stories in that way.
That's just so beautiful. I'm just thinking when you said 15 years, that's just so incredible because the changes that we've had in at least 15 years, I don't even have the words to explain for those of us who've been on this journey for a very long time. And to now know there are therapists specializing in trauma and get it and understand the honor and privilege it is to walk somebody who's been through that and who is wanting a compassionate witness and wanting some support and to come back home to their body to feel safe in life.
Amazing. I mean, I was just thinking as you were talking, when I started out, CPTSD was still being discussed as to whether it should be a separate component of PTSD. And, you know, that probably sounds crazy these days, but that was where we were in the discussion. And we hadn't, you know, differentiated what we would now consider a single event PTSD to complex PTSD. And we also hadn't even broadened the idea of what is trauma. I think I originally started out in training. I mean, we were probably still discussing trauma as, I guess, what we would have classically considered a sort of single event PTSD criteria. And actually that discussion's really, really broadened out, which is so needed, but we've come a long way fighting for trauma to be acknowledged for what it is.
Yeah. When you said that, I just instantly felt that. I just can remember going for help. And this was, of course, a while ago, and feeling that I desperately needed support. I say that when you've had childhood trauma, for me, it was starting at birth. It is like you've been through a war. And then having the professional look at you and look at their manual, well, you don't qualify because it's not a single event. You just feel like you're going to just fall apart. You do feel like you've been through the worst war you could ever even. There's, again, no words. And isn't that part of complex trauma? No words.
Absolutely. And I think of, you know, discussions I would have been, or would have been very, very common 15, 20 years ago. People given different diagnoses when actually they were PTSD survivors. And we just didn't give the space or the time or the light or the reverence or all of those things that CPTSD really does. Trauma's obviously a journey for a trauma survivor. And as you've shared, you're a trauma survivor. I am one myself as well. And it's do you know, I still think I'm on that journey, actually, of learning all that impacts me as a clinician, as a mom, as a woman, as all those things. I think I'm still on that journey, actually. It's been a couple of decades now, but I'm still on it.
Yeah. And I think all of us are, because that's how it impacts. It impacts every facet of our lives, and it is in us. So, you know, we used to think that it was something outside of us, or that it was, you know, it happened there. It's an event. And no, it's inside of us, because we feel those patterns are playing out, and those triggers are showing up. And, you know, our brains are that, I always say our brains are like, this is like that, you know, this connector. So we're constantly like there, even though we're not there, we're there. And yeah, I just feel that something has just come up to me, and I just feel like I want to say it. And for those of you who are listening to this episode, and you might be someone who has suffered for a very long time, and you too were bypassed because they did not recognize that what you were experiencing was complex trauma. And I want to say, if you haven't heard it before, I want to be the voice to say, I am so sorry. You did not deserve that. And what you had was really, or what you have, has been really significant. It impacted you, and you are worthy of being, of naming that and of healing. So just wanted to say that to the listeners. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. You matter.
So true. It's so true. And I think we also have, you know, we've done a bit of a disservice in the psychological community to survivors of trauma. I'd like to think we're trying to heal it now, but we've really, really ignored so many different types of trauma. I mean, I was just talking to you earlier about I have had two children, and I had difficult deliveries with both of them, and I had very significant birth trauma from one of them. And I've just started a discussion, sort of a clinical discussion in the kind of psychology community about that. And it was overwhelming to me how much that is not also ignored. I mean, that's almost considered not a trauma. I mean, we're now starting to have a discourse about that, but there's so much of life. I think we haven't listened to people's experience.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of ground to cover, actually. Yeah.
And there is so much to talk about. And we were talking about a topic that I cannot believe in all the years I've been doing this podcast, I haven't had one specifically on generational trauma. And of course, it's such a mega topic, and there's so many facets of it. And maybe you can tell us, when we talk about generational trauma, in terms of being a survivor of complex trauma, how does that relate to generational trauma?
Generational trauma as a concept, I think if we're going to do it, it's sort of fair service, was often referred to for survivors of, or the descendants of, I should say, survivors who had been as part of a very massive collective trauma. So the Holocaust being a prime example, where there was a lot of generational trauma studies done, and the impact of being parented by somebody who suffered from PTSD. Again, we should be absolutely clear here, very complex PTSD.
Okay.
It would be a disservice to discuss that as PTSD. Alongside, there have been other kind of generational traumas around other people who've had sort of other enormous cultural traumas and what that is to be parented by someone with PTSD. But I think what we also have started to explore, certainly also within the family systems theory, when we're doing genograms, and I don't know if listeners kind of know what a genogram is, some of you might, some of you won't, but it's essentially where we do, it looks like a family tree, but what we're doing is we're marking on there things like birth order, we're marking on there mental health history, trauma history, so addictions, loss of pregnancies, major traumas they suffered. This is particularly important when we look at whole generations that were affected by world wars, that kind of thing. And then we actually start to map what the patterns that have been carried down the lineage. Or, I mean, in my work, it would be within your parenting history. So, for example, we're looking at how you were parented and how that affects how you parent. And also, let's look at the generation above that. So let's look at your grandparents' generation. Because we often talk about our parents and we often give a lot of discourse to what our experience of being parented by them was, but actually what was their experience of being parented? And I know in my clinical work how much actually I recognize I haven't given enough thought to that layer above.
Yeah.
You know, there's that parenting layer and we're always keen to discuss that in the therapy space, but actually the layer above that and if you do know the layer above that, what's coming down through those messages, let's think about, you know, what is considered a good mother in your parenting lineage, what is considered a good father, what is considered a successful child. All of those sort of cultural values, all of those personal values, they come from a generational lineage, and so important we actually look at that because it tells us so much about ourselves, I think. So for me, generational trauma is we're looking at what's happened to the generations above us and how that might have impacted them and how that might have impacted the way they lived, the way they parented, the beliefs they had, the values they had, all of that stuff.
Yeah, I read something, I think it was this week, something to the effect of, you know, you're inhabiting your parents, I don't know if it's their experiences. And I know that to be true now, but I think when I started on the healing journey, that would have made no sense to me, really. I guess I didn't really think it through. What? No, because all I knew was my direct experience. But as I've learned more, it actually is so true. And just in the way that you explained, because of the experiences that they have had. So just for example, I know one thing, I've talked to friends of mine whose parents experienced war, very little food because of war. And their idea was that if their children were fed and clothed, then that was being a good parent. Essentially, it's the, you know, there's no time when you're in a state of survival like that. There was really no time for thinking about anything else. That was kind of the mentality. And that got kind of passed down.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think I was just kind of thinking as I was thinking about how our parents were parented. I also just want to say to listeners, I do a lot of work with adult survivors of child abuse, and actually very specifically adult survivors of child sexual abuse. And I really feel like I need to say this, that in no way is the way your parent was parented a reason or a condoning or forgiveness of what may have happened to you or what their actions were as an adult. And I think that's really important that this is important information. And in some circumstances, it might help us find compassion for our parent. But if your parent has done something that is truly abhorrent, it doesn't mean to say that when we're looking at generational trauma lineages that we're saying, and you must forgive them because of this, because that's absolutely not what we're saying. I guess I just really felt like we need to acknowledge that as well. The choices of adults are not defined by the, you know, we can't forgive certain things within parents, for example.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, I personally have struggled with things, and I am sure other people may as well. For example, that idea of, like, I've learned a lot about emotionally immature parents or those that don't have that capacity to self-reflect. And we know how we're so greatly harmed by that because we're not seen or known. Mm-hmm. But if they don't have the capacity, it's like they don't have a right arm. And if they don't have a right arm, how can I be mad at them for not having a right arm? But at the same time, the harm was still done. And that matters. So it's this, that's why it can sometimes feel like we can understand, but we also, it's also not right. And our pain matters. And I think everybody's journey in terms of however they want to forgive or not forgive or have a relationship or not have it, that is their choice. Now it's coming more into discussion about how if someone is choosing to have no contact, often, well, in the past, people would jump on them like, that's wrong. But now we kind of say nobody would choose to want to not have contact. There is a reason. We need to honor that. We need to honor that, that there's a story behind that.
Absolutely. And to honor the survivor's choice for agency, for taking back control, for saying, this happened to me and this wasn't right. This was my story. This is my true story. Because the other thing we know with survivors of abuse, for example, or trauma, it doesn't have to necessarily categorize as certain types of abuse. They are so often, their story and their narrative is so often diminished or gaslit to tell them that this, it wasn't really that bad. And actually, when they make choices, like, for example, going no contact, they're really honoring that narrative. Yes. And this is true. This is true for what happened to me. And so I think we need to pay a lot of reverence to that, actually, and support them in that.
Me too. I really do. And it's a tough thing. But again, like you said, the word agency, and that is something that we didn't have. And it's really important that we exercise that when we feel called to it. So, yeah. But back to, you know, generational trauma, it's just so interesting. Because the generations of the past, we understand that, you know, the experiences that they've been through. I think of myself and I come from a family where, and I'm going to talk about the direct experience of my mom and my mom. Yep. And her mother's relationship and then her mother's mother. But I'm not going to talk about other siblings because we know that, you know, you hear in families, they can all have different experiences.
But that was their story to tell. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm not going to go into details of my childhood here, but we didn't have a connection. It was unsafe. And I remember asking, what the heck happened that this is what I'm living with now in terms of my childhood and as an adolescent with my caregiver? Like, what happened in that family? And when I began to ask, I was immediately cut off as if I had asked the most horrible thing. I was shut down immediately. So that was like clue number one. What I do know is that there was a lot going on and there was not a safe attachment between my mother and her mother. There was a lot more that wasn't there. And so my mother didn't experience attachment with her mom. She didn't know what that was like. And I did not have that experience with my mother. What I also know is that my grandmother's mother was the same way. I've heard stories of how she was not safe to her own daughter. So now we're seeing this great grandmother, mother. I'd like to say that I was able to break it. Not that I was a perfect parent by far. But I understood, I had awareness, I had compassion, and I worked hard to try to have that connection. So even if we say we're going to do things differently, it's behind us. We are still experiencing the impact. And that's what we started talking about with you, Allison, the impact of other people's choices, relationships, and then we are...
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Left with it.
Absolutely. And I think what's really important for me is helping parents to recognize that sometimes the way we are parenting, you know what, parents are so hard on themselves. It's so interesting to me. You said, oh, I'm not a perfect parent. And of course, no one's a perfect parent, but it's very common for us to, it's very common actually for parents to say that I haven't done the job I wish I'd done, or to be very, very sort of self-deprecating, really. And I think I really would like to get to a space with parents where we can think about the parenting choices we're making might be because of the way we were parented, and we can give a lot of compassion and time for that. And actually, when we do, we can become better parents as a result. And yes, you noticing like the attachment patterns within your grandmother, within your mother, and then actually thinking, you know what, I recognize that this is the attachment message and the lineage that's passed to me, but I'm not going to continue this on, is exactly what we're talking about. It's about recognizing that truth and then having compassion for it, really.
So I like that, having compassion. But you're also saying, or you are saying, from what I hear, is that but compassion on yourself, giving yourself compassion, which is so important, because you can imagine in those kinds of environments, I don't even know what compassion or self-compassion feels like, or define it, like it's totally foreign. And yet that is so much what we need.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think I see sometimes parents who've come from backgrounds where maybe they are survivors of abuse. And it's really important that we unpick that with kind of the love and the care that it deserves, and help them to see that sometimes that means that they will parent in a way that is reflecting what their inner world was, because their inner world was a space of danger and shame. And for them, now they have this child who they're viewing as an extension of themselves. They're so triggered and scared by this child out into the world, because of their own inner world as a child was a dangerous space, that actually that can, and we can unpick that compassionately, that can impact the way that they're parenting. It can mean that, for example, I think this is really triggering in adolescence, when our adults are, you know, exploring sexuality or wanting to dress a certain way. And you can find, for a traumatized parent, that's deeply triggering. That's deeply frightening. And that's, again, that's related to their experiences. And we can explore that. We can also explore, you know, why it might feel like you worry about them outside of your care with certain adults. And of course, that's a sensible thing to think. But when someone's suffered trauma, it can actually be, it can be very exaggerated, that response. I sometimes think, you know, when you get on a plane and they tell you to put your own gas mask on first before your child. And I think it's really sensible advice, because actually, as a parent, we're always told, prioritize your survival, because we forget to. We just prioritize our child's survival. Mm-hmm. So when traumatized parents can be, it's very difficult not to imagine that your child's childhood will be the same as your one was. And actually to be able to take a step back, mm-hmm, and say, I trust I can keep you safe. It's deep work.
It's stuff. Definitely deep work, because what you're talking about is, we want to show our children that the world is a safe place, that we're safe, we can keep them safe. And yet, if we've had complex trauma, it's deep work to learn how do we self-regulate what we're carrying inside, the dysregulation and all of, you know, all of that. And so when you said put on the mask, are you talking about working on some of that?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think it's also, it can be, I think this is particularly triggered in around the idea of anger and the emotion of anger, and how that can play out in discipline situations. If anger in your house was a method to punish and control, that was the weapon of control, or maybe you witnessed conflicts in your home that were not healthy conflicts, and you've learned to interpret the idea of conflict as potentially life-threatening. When you to, let's say, have a conflict, if it were, or a discipline situation with your child, you might find yourself in a fight-flight response. You might actually find yourself fighting. So you're overly you're feeling really triggered that this child won't listen to you, and you're reminded of your parent thinking, you know, only naughty children don't listen to you. So that means that you've done a bad job as a parent if your child's disobeying you. Or you might actually find you flight or fawn because you're frightened of the conflict, and you find that you will back away from the conflict of your child. All of this stuff is massively deep work, but it's about looking at what was anger like in your home? What were conflicts like in your home? Were they healthy? Were they safe? What's your relationship to that emotion? Because I think it's an emotion. I think it's an emotion that is often associated with aggression, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially, like you said, if we've had those experiences that come to mind where maybe the caregiver or someone in the family would be out of control and angry, that triggers, I mean, a nervous system response. And that's why when you said deep work, this is why therapy is so helpful. Because, you know, the awareness and understanding is one thing, and then also understanding this body of ours that is remembers and that is still in survival, and that we have to look at that. So it's really looking at both and working with both. And that's the deep work.
I also, in therapy, sometimes you'll meet a lot of people that I sort of say people who everything was fine in childhood. And what that says to me is someone was told that emotions are not really welcome here to some extent. And actually, that can almost be some of the most insidious type of trauma, because you don't recognize you have it. And it might be only within parenting, where there's all sorts of, you know, conflict situations, emotional situations going on, that you recognize you feel really triggered by your child's big emotions, and you really want to just stop them. Because emotions weren't welcome, we didn't discuss them. That's not what we did here. You can see this quite commonly as well in, I guess the strict term would be within affluent neglect. So parents who maybe, or households who maybe had all the outward trappings of, you know, a house and food and education and healthcare and all of that stuff. But actually there was no emotional kindness or attachment there. And that person has interpreted that their needs or their feelings are not welcome here, and they're unnecessary, they're a hindrance and all that sort of stuff. And
that is so huge.
We need work to unpick that and then see how that impacts your parenting relationships, your romantic relationships, all sorts of stuff. But oh my goodness, emotions and how they were handled in your childhood is huge work.
Oh, huge. And that, again, it connects right to generational trauma, because if we think of those times, emotions, they were not talked about. They were not understood. They were to ignore. You sucked it up. So there wasn't a language for that. So you just stuffed it. And we know what stuffing does. It goes somewhere. It shows up somehow. And so, yeah. Yeah.
Do you know, I remember, like, in my own childhood, I think, I don't know if it was a British thing, I'm sure it transcends cultures, but there was almost this discussion of, at mealtimes, we have to finish your plate because there's starving children in the world. And actually the idea that everyone, there's people who have it worse than you, that was like a blanket cover. And yes, of course, that is ostensibly true, but what it's actually doing is it's being a blanket cover for, and your emotion and your, is not welcoming here, because I interpret that as complaining. I interpret you sharing an emotion as complaining, and that's definitely not welcome here. Mm-hmm. So we flatten the child's needs, really. And mm-hmm. I mean, if we think back 100 years ago, that idea of children should be seen and not heard. I mean, think about the damage to the world.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, and then we wonder, because then we grow up and sometimes we then might find ourselves in relationships similar to what we experienced, because we just tend to move to what's familiar. And so we might find ourselves in relationships with people very much like our caregivers. And yeah. And So emotions are so important to talk about. And so how do you, as a psychologist and someone who is working with people like that, how do you begin to help people to notice that they have emotions or that emotions are okay when they are not used to feeling them?
I think in the first instance, it is that deep work and that deep discussion around how were conflicts handled in your household? How were you consoled in your household? Who did you go to? What was your parenting experience truly? And to allow someone to say it wasn't all good. And also to say, you know, that there can be light and shade within parenting. So I think in the first instance, it's that. But it's about also then looking at, if they are a parent, for example, what are the parenting moments? Because I think this is always good sort of investigative work. What are the parenting moments that really caused you shame or humiliation? What do you look back on and think, I wish I'd done that differently? And then using that fact or that kind of fact-finding exercise, think, and what were you telling yourself internally about what was happening there? So not what your child was doing, but so let's say, for example, your child was, you were struggling, they were being, in your eyes, defiant. So don't focus on what they were doing, but think about the internal messages you were telling yourself around, I need to control this, this frightens me, or this says I'm this type of parent. What other people around? What other people watching? Because I think that's deeply triggering to have the observer whilst you're parenting. And I think when we then start unpicking these examples, we can really start understanding what were we told as a child about emotions and what's welcome in this house and what's not, really.
Wow. I think it feels like such a sacred place to be able to bring that in therapy, to ask those kinds of questions, because we're focusing at that moment on the child's behavior, for example. But really, those questions that you just posed are very, very self-reflective and can change a lot or open up a lot when we understand that. So that's really good.
Yeah, I think another question that's often quite important for parents to ask themselves is, what is your expectation of a successful child? And so what does that look like? What do they do? Is that grades? Is that the way they see the adults? Is that, what is that? And also then, how realistic are those expectations? And are they yours or are they society's? Are they mums? Are they your grandmother's? Are they all of that stuff? I think that's, again, really deep work to look at. I'm asking my child to do this and I'm telling them that this is expected of them, but do I actually? For example, if you're angry, it can sometimes be a good question to ask yourself, can I change this? And also, how much does it matter if I don't? So how much am I responding to this because I think I have to? And actually, how much control do I have here? I think it's such a re-triggering experience being a parent, I think. I just want to give a lot of compassion to parents and say that it's okay that you didn't, you know, that you parent from your own experiences, because we're so used to telling parents these days what they've done wrong and what they shouldn't have done and all this stuff. So I think it's important to look at.
I was talking to somebody yesterday and she was talking about how at one point she was looking at her daughter and she realized how much her daughter reminds her of herself when she was that age, which is very common. And that can be really triggering because we're sort of seeing ourselves in that moment.
I know that within my own daughter, when I think of, say, let's say she's having friendship challenges in the playground, and it's so instinctive for me to jump in with experiences when actually that's not what's really needed here. She wants me to listen to her experiences, but I'm already back in the playground, you know. With the minute she tells me that story, that's where I'm at. And it's about, like, you're not always going to do it right in the moment, but it's about then giving yourself the space to reflect on what was that really about.
what you just said about they want you to just listen to them. I, like you, would have been on the playground. I wouldn't have been a great space to just listen because I'd want to fix it, you know,
or feel like the anger or feel the, you know, feel the rage and all that. And is that theirs or is that yours? I think that's important to look at.
Oh, yes, that's a very good question. Yeah, as you were saying that, it was mine.
Again, it was mine as well. It was mine as the child. It was mine. It was all of mine.
How important is it for the child to be heard in that moment? Like, what does that child need when they're sharing something like that, a conflict?
I think they need the space to tell the story from their perspective. Of course, by all means, particularly if the child's quite young, they might need some help with offering emotional language. But I think it's good in that instance to say, is it like this or is it a bit like this? So give choices. Don't narrate over their experience. But what they really need is a space to say, this happened to me today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about you jumping in with when I was your age, because then that kind of flips the conversation around to you. When actually they need you to be that benevolent and kind observer and witness to what happened to them today.
Wow. I'm just thinking about how I'm careful and I'm sensitized to people who are emotionally immature and then twist a conversation, making it about them.
Yeah.
And then when you just gave that example, when I was a child, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, how many times have I might have done that?
Sure, I've done it too. I mean, yeah, you know, we've done it, but it's about being mindful that we try not to do it. I think that's the key kind of point here.
Yeah, well, that was a really good piece for awareness, at least for me. My kids are grown now, but for the listeners, and one day I'll be a grandparent. Is there anything else you want to share with regards to generational trauma? Then we can move on a little bit just about your new book that's come out.
I think that's the main part. I think generational trauma is about working through not just your trauma, but really trying to understand the experiences of your parents, your grandparents. And some of that's, you know, it's going to be lost to history. There are going to be gaps.
Yeah.
But just doing as much work as you can in understanding what's passed through your emotional DNA and what's that told you, really. And I think that's really, really helpful, not just for being a parent, but for all parts of your life.
I so agree. Yeah, there was a time where I wanted to know what happened, but then I was like, no, it's not good. I think that having that understanding, it does give us context. When we have context, we feel a sense of agency. We feel better. We feel safer. Thank you for this conversation. I wanted to just touch a bit on your new book called How to Help Your Child Cope with Anything. That's a huge title.
I know.
I like the cover.
Thank you. A huge title.
Yeah. I listened to it on Audible and I really, really liked it.
Oh, thank you. The focus of the book is actually on what I'm referring to in the book as small T traumas. So incidences that have traumatic impact. As we were talking about earlier, we didn't used to categorize, for example, bullying, bereavement, divorce, all of these things as trauma, but we now know how much traumatic impact all of those things have. The book is designed to help parents and caregivers in general to navigate those, have those discussions really with their child. And I designed a technique in it that I've called Extract, Express, Reflect, but it's essentially just a three-step process, which is around how to have those conversations and with a, you know, with a trauma-informed mind. So in the first instance, we're trying to extract all the information because we know that, and as soon after the event as possible, because we know that traumatic memory isn't always stored accurately. Then we're trying to help the child express. So here we're looking for the emotional language. And then after that, we're looking for reflect, because actually what we're trying to do is we're not trying to say that what happened to the child was a positive thing, but we're trying to help the child find a narrative of agency or control within that. So for example, if it was trauma of bullying, we're in that circumstance trying to help the child draw out within their own narrative what they did that was courageous, what they did that was brave, what they did that was, you know, really was gave them back their own agency and sense of self. Because we know within trauma that one of the most insidious messages you can get is I feel helpless, or I did do, I should have done. And so it's quite an easy kind of three-step sort of instruction, really, for having those conversations. But I think more than anything, I wanted to write a book that was not super heavy on psychological theory, but had enough, but also then really talked about what it really is to be a parent in this world and what it is to, you know, to parent from our own trauma spaces as well, and to have compassion for that, because a lot of parenting literature doesn't look at that. It started to, but it's historically parental theory and child psychology theory definitely didn't give a lot of space to the trauma of the parents. It was very much about, you've either done this right or you've done this wrong. So I wanted to, in a way, I kind of wanted it to be a bit of a love letter to parents, say, a tough job, but, you know, if your intention was good, I bet you've done a good job, kind of thing.
That's really great. Well, thank you. I will put the link in the show notes.
And you?
Yes. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, I will put your information also in the show notes. But how could they reach you? Are you on Instagram?
I'm on Instagram. I've got a website. I will link that also for you. And I'm responsive on both of those mediums.
Well, thank you for today.
So much. It was such a pleasure.
Professionals spend nearly half the work week on written communication, so focus is important. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, focus and quickly get through your work with relevant, real-time suggestions. And it works across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can sound more confident and persuasive wherever you write. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.